welcome to Spotlight On, where we put the spotlight on change makers and experts in the field of safeguarding. Throughout the series, we'll have conversations with those who can offer insights that can help us all to better understand safeguarding and improve our practices. This podcast is produced by the Safeguarding Resource and Support Hub, also known as RSH. RSH supports organizations in the humanitarian and development sector to strengthen their safeguarding policy and practice. I'm your host, Andrea Watkins. I'm the Technical Director for the Safeguarding Support and Resource Hub. On today's episode, we will discuss safeguarding within education programming, featuring what works and lessons learned from the Link Ethiopia Stages team. Let's get started. In this episode, I'll be talking with Niccolo DiMarzo, Ethiopia Country Representative of Link Education International, and Betty Saleshi, Safeguarding Gender and Social Inclusion Officer at Link Education Ethiopia. Thank you so much both for joining us. And Niccolo, I'd like to start with you, if you could tell us about your role and the overall aims and objectives of the Link Ethiopia project.
Hi, Andrea. Thank you so much for asking this question, and thank you so much for having us. Basically, as you said, I'm the country representative of Link Education International here in Ethiopia. I'm based in Addis Ababa, and I'm talking to you from Addis, actually, as of now. And yeah, basically, the work of Link Education has been in Ethiopia for the last 12 years, particularly with the Stages project, which is actually our flagship project in the country. And well, as you may know, the Stages project has been under the GEC, or Girls Education Challenge Program, which has been this huge, actually, program from FCDO and the former DFID on girls' education. I think it has been the biggest girls' education program worldwide, which has been implemented in more than 18 countries, and we have been lucky to be one of them. Basically, our work in Ethiopia has been very much focusing on primary and secondary education and girls' education, particularly on the transition from primary to secondary, because it's during that transition that most of the girls we work with do drop out. And we have received actually very good results with regard to learning, transition, and sustainability. For example, when we talk about learning, of the total number of girls which have been enrolled at baseline, and we are talking of 2017, almost 60% of them are improved learners. And for example, this is particularly evident when coming to functional literacy and numeracy, which is basically the core sort of focus of our program. Although, of course, reading comprehension remains still a challenge, but in general, our girls have achieved very good results on literacy and numeracy. Also, with regard to transition, a majority of Stages girls have also indicated that they want to continue to go to secondary school after they've completed grade 10. I think actually around 90% of girls say they wish to go to secondary school, and main reason being school is actually a girl-friendly and a safe place. A girlfriend space and a safe place actually for them. And with regards actually to sustainability, we could say actually we have achieved very good results, because we have been working hand in hand with the government on incorporating different strategy into their strategic plan, particularly actually the three strategies that we want to incorporate, and they're going to survive after, or at least we believe they're going to survive after the project ends this year in August 2024, are pedagogical leadership and supervision training, gender responsive training, and safeguarding. Why we chose actually safeguarding as one of the three activities to have a better, say, sustainability rate is because, well, first of all, actually, everything we have been doing around safeguarding is aligned with government policy and priorities. The National Ministry of Education National Gender Strategy is very clear on reducing, preventing, and addressing school-related gender-based violence, including corporal punishment. And also the Ethiopian National Social Protection Policy is also very much around ensuring that child protection is always considered when, you know, we do education. And well, the reason actually why we do focus so much on safeguarding is because our project has been working in partnership with government, schools, and communities to improve understanding of the education barriers the girls face and how these barriers can intersect to become insurmountable for some of them. Because as you may know, actually, when unsupportive cultural and societal norms intersect with individual characteristics, could be, for example, a girl with a disability, unconducive learning environment, could be a school without a washing facility, the inability to meet the hidden cost of education, which could be, for example, stationary materials or uniforms, the challenge of adolescence and the limited capacity of the education system to support girls, actually quality education can really become distant for many of them.
No, that is so much to unpack there. And it's all exactly, you're speaking to the thematic elements that, you know, speak to the need for safeguarding and to think about safeguarding mainstreaming in such a large program and how you do that. And so we're so looking forward to speaking with you, and we'll kind of talk through how you've done that and how you've achieved that success and for some of the world's most vulnerable female learners in particular. So thank you so much, Niccolo, and we want to unpack some of this in our conversation. So Betty, for you, what's your role as safeguarding gender and inclusion officer? What does that entail, especially off the back of Niccolo's given us a nice overview of the program and its successes so far?
Okay, thank you. Niccolo explained it well, actually. And as a safeguarding officer, my roles include like promoting the well-being of children, as we are working on children's, actually protecting them from harm, abuse, and like delivering training, yes. Make sure policies are effected and implemented well. Also, like, ensure all concerners get their answers, coordinate with like child protection officers, and promote child safeguarding within and outside, I mean, within school and outside. Also, make sure the staff well-being and safeguarding, actually.
That's excellent. Sounds like such a critical role that you play on the program, Betty. And so I think, Niccolo, back to you, and this is also, you know, for you as well, Betty. So thinking about, you know, the program strengths, the pillars that you've talked about, how within that were you able to develop specific safeguarding systems tailored to the program? And can you say a little bit about how you managed to secure the funding to deliver on that mandate?
Thank you so much, Andrea. I think actually we talk more from an organizational perspective, and Betty, we talk more from a program perspective. So, well, first of all, actually what we did, as you know, every organization nowadays is required to have a code of conduct and have actually specific safeguarding procedures and manuals. So, for example, we develop our safeguarding policy, child safeguarding policy, and basically we ensure that those all those policies and procedures are accessible to all our staff. We develop a SharePoint folder where actually staff can easily access, and we translated some of those policies into Amharic, which is the language of Ethiopia, so that actually everybody can access to it. Then another thing actually that we do, as any other organization, actually we try to have a very strict, safe recruitment and selection of personnel and partners. And for example, actually, when usually we, you know, hire new staff, we ask reference check. We also ask police check to ensure that, you know, they don't have any criminal record. And of course, actually, another thing that we do, we provide actually continue awareness and training. And to be honest, actually, safeguarding resource and support hub has been very instrumental on that, because actually we get a lot of materials from it. And this year we even develop a quiz to actually make, you know, safeguarding refresher training a little bit more fun for our staff. We are lucky enough, to be honest with you, we have to have a person like Betty, who is actually a safeguarding gender inclusion officer. So basically she ensures that whatever we do at program level also follows, of course, safeguarding policy and procedures, but also she's kind of able to kind of, you know, being there with us and to guide us on, you know, what to do. So like funding wise, actually, we've been very lucky to have a program like the FCDO's funded stages one, which actually has safeguarding as one of its core activities and a dedicated person. However, at the same time, I believe that even for program who don't have a dedicated person focusing on safeguarding, you could also have some safeguarding focal point. To be honest, actually, we also have this figure of safeguarding focal point in our organization. Basically, those are people who have kind of taken the extra role of being a safeguarding focal point. We have one in Addis Ababa, for example. We have one in our field office in Sodo in South Ethiopia, which is where the Stages project is implemented. And those people, they basically serve to ensure that whatever policy and procedure is put in place, but also in the event that there is a safeguarding concern, staff can actually report the safeguarding concern to them. Of course, actually, staff, as we know, can report a safeguarding concern to their line manager, or they can report it, for example, to me as the head of the organization here in Ethiopia. But in case, you know, they don't feel comfortable because, you know, of, you know, power dynamics, they can also report it to the safeguarding focal point. And those are, of course, people who have been trained on this, and they take the extra role of being a safeguarding focal point. And then, of course, as you know, one of the most important things we do with safeguarding at organizational level is about reporting. And one of the things actually that we have introduced maybe 2 years ago was the old whistleblowing email, which of course is a common practice for a lot of organizations, which once again is an anonymous whistleblowing hotline where people can report any kind of safeguarding concern they may have. And we believe that, of course, the most important thing is to try, you know, to walk the talk, basically to ensure that whatever we say on a policy level is also implemented on the ground. And then, you know, our policies are basically put into practice. So for us, we try to maintain a safeguarding culture, which focuses on prevention rather than punishment. And we try to do so by promoting staff well-being, in the sense that we try actually to have a culture, organizational culture, which have a good work-life balance, where, yeah, the well-being and the health and the so-called duty of care nowadays of staff is taken into consideration always.
Excellence. That so many concrete ideas of how you've been able to mainstream safeguarding infrastructure, all different levels, as you've said, and there's so many components there with well-being and thinking about reporting pathways, whistleblowing, staff recruitment and selection, and strict enforcement and commitment to training. Those are all so key, and I'm glad you found the RSH resources have been helpful in your safeguarding journey. I think Betty, did you want to come in on that point? Because I think it leads nicely into kind of what are some of the challenges and risks that you mapped for your learners that, you know, made these changes absolutely necessary to ensure a safer program. Did you have any thoughts or reflections from your perspective?
Yeah, actually, Nicola said it well, how we develop effective safeguarding system within our organization. And let me add some points as how we develop an effective safeguarding system within our program. Actually, it's to develop an effective safeguarding system, it's required a encompass several key elements, because like everybody is not aware of safeguarding as it is a recent concept. So the first thing that we do is like creating awareness in education about safeguarding. As I said, it is not like it is a recent concept, so everybody is not that aware. So we prioritize raising awareness about safeguarding issues like among program participants, staff, and stakeholders. So by providing like training sessions, educational materials, and conducting community campaigns about safeguarding related issues, and like transmitting safeguarding related messages through education dramas and forms. So we ensure that everyone involved had like a clear understanding of what safeguarding is and what constitutes abuse, the sign to look out for, and like the importance of reporting incidents. So the other is like we have a safeguarding policy. So we implement and do activities accordingly and by affecting our safeguarding policies, so that others will understand how we are serious about safeguarding and within and outside the organization, and also like we make ourselves clear about safeguarding. So by addressing various aspects like including reporting procedures, confidentiality, and by clearing and articulating our expectation and guidance, like we establish a framework for safeguarding within our program. The other key element that we use to develop effective safeguarding system within the program is like by establishing different reporting mechanisms. Like we implement accessible and confidential reporting mechanisms to encourage individuals to come forward with any concerns or incidences. This includes establishing dedicated reporting channels such as letter link boxes so that individuals can write their concerns, and the other is a service map, which encompasses phone number of responsible individuals, like safeguarding focal points in the specific area, so that anybody can call directly where individuals could report abuse or seek guidance. Also, there is a structure called like mother and father group, which is particularly doing a lot of work on safeguarding and protecting children and individuals from abuse. So we ensure that these mechanisms were like well publicized and easily accessible to all program participants. And we frequently update the reporting mechanisms if there is any change. And the other is like referral networks, like by recognizing the importance of providing support to victims, we establish partnership with different local authorities, like with legal authorities. So this allowed us to offer immediate assistance, counseling, and referrals to individuals who reported incidents of abuse. So by connecting victims with the appropriate resource, we ensure they received the support they needed to navigate and healing processes. So further, we regularly evaluate the effectiveness of our safeguarding systems through feedback mechanisms by doing assessments and monitoring processes. So these are like some key elements that we use to develop effective safeguarding system within our program.
Thank you so much, Betty. You've said so many very, very helpful things, and especially the risk mapping that you've talked about and the other stakeholders and connecting survivors to trusted service providers. That's very, very important and so key to a robust safeguarding approach. This links to what you've just said, Betty, and in terms of how you're working with wider community members, stakeholders, as well as learners and their families. How have you dealt with any pushback or resistance, and how have you been able to maintain a good relationship with families, community stakeholders on an agenda such as safeguarding?
Actually, as I said before, it's like everybody is new about the safeguarding concept itself. So what we are doing is like maintaining good communication with like clear communication, like by providing clear and concise information about safeguarding, about support of families and communities and stakeholders, what safeguarding is itself, clearly explain the purpose and importance of safeguarding and in promoting well-being and safety of learners. We also provide trainings for different stakeholders about safeguarding related issues so that they can acquire like the important knowledge of about safeguarding. Also by collaborating partnership, because foster partnership is families and communities organization to promote a shared understanding of safeguarding so that they can share their understanding with others as well. So engaging open dialogue, listen to their concerns and make them understand what abuse is.
Thank you. Very helpful. And I completely agree with what you said around clear communication and approaching this as very much a partnership of shared understanding. That's so critical that you engage in that way so that this is seen as a collaborative, a participatory approach. So I guess in terms of thinking about what you've said and some of the amazing practices that you've embedded within the program, are there things that you've done specifically or how have you been able to refine and capture the views of children? Are there particular techniques? Are there ways that you are doing it on the program that you think have worked really well and that have also helped embed and further understanding of safeguarding within your learners?
Create a safe and inclusive environment is important. I learned that because like foster an environment where children feel comfortable expressing their views and opinions is like a key, and encouraging open communication, like actively listen to what they have to say is important because they feel like they are heard. The other is like using child-friendly and age-appropriate methods when we are working with children, because like employ creative and interactive techniques to engage children in discussions, like visual, like use visual aids, drawing aids, or playing. Actually, we are doing it by ourselves when we are in the area. So using child friendly and appropriate method and respect and validate their views, because as I said before, they feel like heard and appreciated. So respect and value their view with the other team, treating children's opinions with respect and like value their contribution, acknowledge their perspective and let them know what their voices matter. So like provide accessible information which is easily understandable for them, and respecting their decision making or making our process like child-centered, because involve children in decision making, like include children in discussion and decision making processes like related with safeguarding and seek their input on in pursuit or activities directly affect those directly can affect them.
Wonderful. It sounds like such a healthy approach, and that you have multiple means of taking a safe and ethical approach to capturing the experiences of children and doing that in a way that is safe and encourages them to express their feelings. So it sounds like there's so much you've learned on your journey. Thank you, Betty. So the final question is, I guess, toward you, Niccolo, is just kind of a big picture question around safeguarding and in the overall organizational journey. Yes, it is personal, but it's an overall journey that an organization's taking. And, you know, can you just describe what are kind of the key components of that and how do you facilitate that change across the whole program and create really inspirational, transformational change that staff can really, really believe in?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, actually, Andrea. As you say, safeguarding could be a personal, but also an organizational journey, because at the end of the day, actually, whatever we learn could be also applied basically to the organization we work with. Personally, I remember in 2018, I was acquainted a little bit more with safeguarding, because, as you know, actually, there was right after the Me Too movement started in October 2017. So somehow actually the Me Too movement has taken, rightly so, the world by storm, and then actually has ended up also influencing the humanitarian and development sector. And all of us at the majority of the organization were basically asked to, you know, have more stringent safeguarding policy and procedure. But at the time, actually, I remember that, of course, some organizations were kind of affected by the whole, you know, safeguarding scandal more than others, but at the end of the day, I think all of us working for different NGOs felt the same sort of shame. But I remember that one of the things that we did with regards actually to, you know, transforming this shame into something positive, at least actually at the organization I was working before, was about you know, ensuring that we have like a clear plan on how to ensure that safeguarding is taken into consideration in everything that we do. But most important is that we do create a working environment which is safe for all. And I think actually one of the main things that we did at the time, and that also we are doing it at Link, is, for example, that to ensure as much as we can actually to have a 50-50 male-female ratio at work. As you know, we live in a patriarchal society, and basically the majority of victims of survivor of safeguarding incident are actually women. So in order actually to reduce that, to at least have a higher component of women staff is like something that could actually reduce the potential safeguard incident in the workplace. And for example, actually, one of the things that we did at Link in 2021 was to launch internship framework for women only, because actually most of the time we hear, you know, this kind of complaint, particularly from male staff, of, you know, it's very difficult to find women staff in Ethiopia, or it's very difficult to find women staff in the global south in general. But most of the time we realize this is sort of an excuse, and it's not true that actually women are not ready to, you know, take up work in our organization, but most of the time actually they basically they're not really opportunities for them. So as an organization actually focusing on girls' education, we have tried to align our programming with kind of our organizational setup. So basically we started this internship framework for women only, either for newly graduated, so women who just actually finished their secondary school, or basically women who are at the last year of their university. And basically we had many women interns, I guess seven or more than that, actually, surely more than seven, basically in the last 2 years. And this has actually changed the shape of our organization, because all of a sudden, while in 2020, we did have around 18% of women staff, in 2022, we have around 40%. So, of course, our goal, which is, again, of achieving an ideal 50-50 split, I think is kind of closer by the day. But most importantly, we are very happy to prove that it is possible to find talented women staff when adequate human resources are put in place. And Betty, for example, is an example of that.
Thank you so much, Niccolo, that you've said some really, really insightful reflections from an organizational perspective. And it's very reassuring that you have thought about gender and thought about kind of the barriers and intersectionality, and that gets woven right into the fabric of your organization and your ethos. So it's so inspirational, and it's clear you've had some really great success with that. So thank you for sharing. One final question that I'd like to circle back to and relates to some of the key challenges and risks that girls and female learners in particular were experiencing, and how this factored into your safeguarding approach with learners. And is there more that you'd like to share with us on that?
Yeah, thank you, Andrea, for this question. Actually, you know, as I said, our Stages project, which is basically one of the flagship projects actually in Ethiopia for Link Education, is implemented in the south of the country in a region which is now called South Ethiopian region, in particular in Wolaita zone. And basically, according to UNICEF Ethiopia, actually, Wolaita zone is identified among the main child trafficking sources in the whole country, contributing 32.6% of child trafficking in the whole country. So child trafficking is actually a problem, particularly for the area where we work. But another actually problem is child marriage. And actually, with regard to child marriage, I remember that we have seen a spike of child marriage, particularly during COVID-19, because schools were closed. Honestly, actually, Ethiopia schools were closed for a shorter time than other countries, because I think actually they were closed for maybe around 3 to 4 months. However, enough actually to unfortunately have some girls marry young. But one of the positive stories that we can share on that was that when we did an assessment right after actually the schools were closed, we realized that 72 of our girls who belong to our project, many under the age of 18, actually were married while schools were closed. So 72, as you could imagine, actually is quite a huge number. But basically, our team actually went door by door and actually to look for those girls, to speak with their husbands, with the families, with their new family member, and to encourage them to return to school to finish their education. And of course, as you know, Betty was saying before, the mother and father group that we have strengthened in the course of the Stages project was actually key in encouraging those girls to come back to school. And we are happy to say that when actually a school reopened, we found out that 65 of the 72 girls actually who were married still came back to school.
Thank you for sharing that aspect of your work. I'd like to ask a question around any advice. So thinking across your journey of Stages and Link Ethiopia, what advice do you have to other projects who might be at an early stage of actually how to really build and monitor safeguarding within a large program?
We have been shared a lot about how we develop effective safeguarding system within our organization and within our program, like by awareness, education, policy development, reporting mechanisms, and other little things. So I advise other programs do the same, but actually to add some advices, like we need to have committed leadership, because we need to ensure that leadership within the organization is like fully committed to safeguarding and set the tone for its importance. They also need to have like a comprehensive risk assessment, because conduct a thorough risk assessment, like specifically to the program, considering factors such as location, participant demographic, and activities involved. So identifying potential risks and vulnerabilities, like particularly those that may increase the likelihood of abuse or exploitation. So, and develop targeted safeguards to address these risks. They also need regular training and refresher sessions. So provide regular training to all program participants, various the staffs and stakeholders on safeguarding protocols like procedures and best practices. So it can open ways how to develop effective safeguarding system within a larger program. So offer refresher sessions to reinforce knowledge and maintain awareness. So ensuring that training materials are accessible, culturally sensitive, and tailored to the specific context of the program. We advise like they also need code of conduct, because develop a comprehensive code of conduct that clearly outlines like expectations for behavior interaction within the program. And this the code should explicitly prohibit abuse, exploitation, and any other form of harmful conduct. So regularly communicate and reinforce the code of conduct to all participants. there's only like independent with confidentiality, like establishing an independent reporting and investigation mechanisms, like to ensure confidentiality and impartiality. So this could involve designating specific individuals or teams responsible for handling safeguarding pointers, as we Nicola and I said before, like safeguarding local persons in every targeted program areas, or there's something like engagement with local communities, like fostering strong relationship and partnership with local communities, like to ensure that safeguarding efforts are like culturally appropriate, sensitive and relevant. There's something like reporting mechanisms, implement the post monitoring system to track and like record safeguarding instances, investigations and outcomes. So finally, I would advise like continuous learning and improvement, because strengthening culture of continuous learning and improvement by regularly reviewing and updating safeguarding policies, procedures, and safeguarding training material. So some of these advice I give.
Yeah, and if I can add something actually on that, Andrea, basically our project is very much a project which is focusing on foundational learning, which is numeracy and literacy particularly. And the reason why we're doing so is actually because, as you know, 4 in 5 children in Africa and actually around 9 in 10 in sub-Saharan Africa struggle to read and comprehend a simple story by age 10. So that's why we have such a strong focus on foundational learning. However, we also attach to foundational learning what we call social-emotional learning, because social-emotional learning actually give us the opportunity to build the girls' self-esteem and confidence so that they can take informed decisions, and they can, for example, actually also have the confidence enough to say no when safeguarding concern may arise or may happen. So we believe actually that this sort of combination of foundational learning and social emotional learning is actually key, because we have seen that when our girls go through this social emotional learning module that we have come up with, also their academic results have improved.
Absolutely. Yes, that is just so helpful and reflective. And I think, Nicola, it's great that you have mentioned social emotional learning is key to establishing agency and participation for girls, and its link to learning outcomes. But also what Betsy said is, and taking it back to, good safeguarding practice on the ground and strong risk assessments, culture and leadership components, and really excellent reporting pathways and case handling procedures. So all of those key components have seemed to be woven together into your program delivery. So I hope our listeners will find some of your suggestions really helpful and food for thought as they are building their own safeguarding infrastructure in their program. So I just want to thank you so much, and to remind our viewers or listeners that we do have products to help you to build some of this. We have risk assessment tools, we have culture and leadership tip sheets and think pieces and other webinars and other types of learning on our website. So please do feel free to dive into our materials on RSH. And I'm really pleased that the Link Ethiopia team have found our RSH resources helpful. So on behalf of RSH, I just want to thank Nicolo. Thank you so much for joining us. And Betty, thank you so much for sharing your time and your lessons and insights and reflections with us. It's given us so much to think about. It's so aspirational. And thank you for sharing your time with us. And we look forward to speaking with you again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Andrea Watkins, and you've been listening to Spotlight On, produced with the support of RSH. Thank you so much for listening. I wish to extend a special thanks to the Link Ethiopia Stages team, Nicolo DiMarzo, National Representative, and Safeguarding Gender and Social Inclusion Officer, Betty Shalazi. I also wish to extend my sincere thanks to the producer of this episode, Judith Almazi. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you want to learn more about this program or any other safeguarding topic, please visit our website, safeguardingsupporthub.org. All of our social media can be found in this episode's information note. If you have any comments or want to share your thoughts or suggest topics for future episodes, contact us via social media on Facebook, LinkedIn, or email. Our email address is info@safeguardingsupporthub.org. Thanks for joining. We will see you next time.